This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, Google, Reason, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and rate and review us while you're there. My guest today is Philip K. Howard, who burst onto the scene of public intellectual debate over 20 years ago with his best-selling book, The Death of Common Sense, How Law is Suffocating America, which argued that out-of-control lawsuits and rules and regulations were choking off vitality, innovation, and common decency in our country. In 2002, he founded Common Good, a nonprofit whose credo is, and I think the libertarians out there will like this, simplify government, put humans back in charge, and cut mindless red tape. A lawyer by training and profession, Howard continues to write books exploring this theme or these themes, and we're here to talk about his latest one, which I highly recommend, Try Common Sense, Replacing Failed Ideologies of Left and Right. We're going to talk about that book, why it's important now, and his critique of libertarianism, which is pretty interesting, to be quite honest. Philip K. Howard, thanks for talking to Reason.
Nice to be with you, Nick.
All right, so let's give me the elevator pitch of the book.
Well, basically, I argue that we'll never cure the alienation of the American voters that got Donald Trump elected and Bernie Sanders' huge support until we give them back the self-respect and ownership of daily choices that people need. And by the way, that's also the only way to make schools work or rebuild infrastructure or make anything work. You know, nothing happens unless a human being makes it happen.
Well, here's a start with an example. And I realized the last time we talked, you talked about a fantastic book that The Rule of Nobody, which is what, like 5 years old now?
Yeah, 5 years old.
And you talked about how it became impossible to kind of retrofit a bridge that would allow New York Harbor, essentially, to get with the 21st century super tanker revolution. In this book, you have a particular example about an orchard that is just overrun with kind of red tape and stupidity. Talk about that.
It's just absurd. So here you have an orchard run by a family. It's in upstate New York. And they're constantly being, it's like death by a thousand cuts. You're constantly being undone by regulation. For example, there's a regulation that you have to cover the cart that has the apples that have been picked on the trip from the orchard to the barn where the apples get washed. And the purpose of the rule is to protect any bird droppings from being on the apples. Now, it's about a two-minute trip from the orchard to the barn. The apples have been exposed to the birds for about 5 months while they've been growing on the tree. It's an absolutely absurd rule.
Right.
There's another rule that requires them to go around and make sure that there are no deer or animal droppings around the orchard so that the droppings don't get on the boots, which then might get on someone's hands if they're climbing a ladder, and if. And of course, that's absurd because it's an orchard. They're out in nature. You know, right. They've got 100 acres of trees. So as the orchard owner said, it's like there's somebody in Washington sitting in front of a screen making things up. Well, of course, that's the case. And then at one point, they're in the middle of the picking season, which is a short period, and they're very busy, and they have temporary workers. And the regulators come in, and they demand all this paperwork. And so they've got notebooks of paperwork, and everybody in the family has to divert themselves from the job of actually picking the apples to filling out these scores of forms. And of course, the regulators find virtually nothing wrong.
Right. So, well, at one point you write that American government is suffering from a failure of philosophy, not merely bad management. So explain how the orchard example kind of illustrates that.
We built the regulatory state really only in the last 50 years on the idea that regulation should tell people how to do things correctly. And I call this in the book the philosophy of correctness. And the result of that is that really everyone, people in offices, people in orchards, you know, people in hospitals, schools, they go through the day and they're about to make a decision and they say, well, can I prove that what I'm going to do is legally correct? Does it comply with a metric? Might it offend somebody? Might it that they claim is their rights or whatever? And so you have this society, you have this regulatory structure where almost anything that you do has legal implications. Well, that's not actually how law is supposed to work. Law is supposed to set outer boundaries to protect against bad things, you know, pollution or people cheating on their contracts. But it's not supposed to, and by doing, by setting those outer boundaries, it defines a field of freedom where people can then focus, you know, on their goals without
so
fear.
So what would be the outer bounds of the fields of freedom? I like that with the orchard. It's,
yeah.
What would, you know.
Yeah, so for example, there could readily be a principle which is you need to, you can't use unlawful pesticides on your apples because they're bad for people. And you, there could be a principle that when the apples leave the orchard, they must be reasonably clean or meet some sort of standard, you know, of cleanliness. So they go through a washing scene. But the notion that they have to comply with literally hundreds of rules from a dozen different agencies that they can't even understand, much less comply with, many of which just resemble, I mean, they're worse than central planning. At least the central planners had in mind getting the apples to the marketplace. You know, covering the cart with canvas doesn't help anyone.
So at another point in the book, you write, we must abandon the philosophy of dictating uniform public choices in tiny detail with its oppressive, huge oppressive bureaucracy and restore human responsibility as the organizing principle in American government. Now that, yeah, I mean, like, you know, as a libertarian, you know, working at Reason, this, you know, it just sings to my heart. When did we, how did we get to a point where uniform public choices are being prescribed in tiny detail?
Well, oddly, conservatives are as much to blame as liberals for this. In order to have a principle-based system where the apples have to be clean, you know, have to be reasonably clean, and you don't use pesticides and such, so a goal-oriented regulatory structure where government is on the sidelines letting people run their orchards the way they want to as long as they comply with these general goals, that requires that these regulatory cops on the sidelines have some measure of freedom to use their judgment. You know, are they doing something wrong here? Is it maybe, you know, this new technique doesn't work or whatever? So you have to actually let if you want infrastructure to be approved, you have to actually give the environmental official the room to say, oh, you're just raising the roadway of the bridge. Give me 50 pages of construction costs and effects, not 20,000 pages in the case of the Bayonne Bridge, you know, of mindless detail. It requires somebody to use their judgment. And one of
so the, it's not just for individuals in society, outside of government, to use their judgment. It's bureaucrats.
It's bureaucrats, too. It's, what we forgot is that freedom is a concentric concept. If the inspector isn't free to use his judgment, within reason, you know, he still have, you know, he has, his discretion has to be bounded by law and principles and all that too. Then pretty soon the citizen is not going to be free either, because somebody's going to find an abuse, and they're going to say, "Oh my God, that restaurant got away with murder when they did this, that, and the other." So we're going to put a detailed rule in that makes every restaurant fill out a form that they won't do something, right? So you've got, because one person did something wrong, you've got a million restaurants filling out forms that nobody cares about. Well, the solution to that is actually to let the inspector with the one restaurant say, you can't get away with that. And if you want to complain, go to my supervisor or go to a court. But I think this is not clean, and therefore I'm going to give you a fine. And if that inspector doesn't have that authority, pretty soon you're going to have 1,000 pages of rules that apply to every restaurant, even if most 998 of them don't make any sense.
How does that square with the, you know, and I think you would agree, it's a legitimate fear that if you give So there are businesses or people, people making buildings, et cetera, in the world. There are bureaucrats and agencies that get to regulate them. And then you're saying that the inspector has a wide, instead of being bound by a set of rules, can come in and say, I like the cut of your jib. I'm right. Giving you a pass on this, but then I'm screwing the guy next door to you.
Yeah. It's the way legal systems have to work is completely utilitarian. The question is kind of what works. There's not a kind of an absolutist idea. Is that the first thing is that regulation should be goals. So, there should be, if it's a safety regulation, the overall goal is the safety of the workplace. And then there should be principles. Tools and equipment shall be reasonably suited for the use intended. That's a principle. You could add in accordance with industry guidelines. There are industry guidelines. They're called, the national standards, called ANSI guidelines and national standards. And so in that situation, someone who is using a dime store hammer on a big construction job, they would say, this hammer is breaking, it's going to be dangerous, the thing's going to fly off. You need to use industrial-grade hammers. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the accountant in the office who wants to hang a picture on his wall and tap in a nail could use the dime store hammer. Mm-hmm. It's, life's too complicated to mandate industrial-grade hammers. But in fact, we have 4,000 worker safety rules that require that you use industrial-grade hammers in the workplace. And they have 7 pages on wooden ladders. And, it's this incredible overwrought detail, whereas other countries, the UK, for example, has a better worker safety regime. They focus on safety. They have principles. It's not just whatever the inspector thinks is safe. There's a set of principles and there are guidelines and they look at metrics and stuff. But what they do is they go and look at workplaces that are unsafe and they figure out why they're unsafe and try to make them more safe or to close them down or whatever. In America, we have millions of workplaces, not nearly enough worker safety regulators. We have 4,000 rules. Every single business is in non-compliance with the rules. The way your wires are set up for this podcast undoubtedly is in non-compliance with the OSHA worker safety rules, so that any inspector who wanted to walk in and be abusive, anyone, can find multiple violations of any regulatory scheme. So the idea was we're trying to prevent regulators from having too much power. In fact, we gave them complete power.
How did we get here? You mentioned, we gave them absolute power and whatnot. How did this kind of, these are kind of accretions, right? Because new regulations get layered on top of old ones. It's like the fossil record.
Each ambiguity leads to another clarification. So government is more paralytic now than it was 5 years ago, than 5 years before.
Was there a particular moment in American history where this switch got flipped on and the sediment started building up and fossilizing?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I go through the history in the book a little bit and also in more history than the prior books. But in 1956, the interstate highway system was authorized with a 29-page statute. 14 years later, it was substantially complete. Mm-hmm. Today, you wouldn't, the statute, the last transportation bill was over 1,000 pages. The implementing regs were thousands of pages. And you wouldn't even be through the environmental review process to start rebuilding a road. So what happened? What happened is after the 1960s, we had this let's remake government imperative because we woke up to abuses like racism and pollution and such. And people said, well, let's stop. We'll guarantee there are no more abuses by turning law into a kind of software program. We're going to make law tell everybody how to do things correctly. And the premise there is demonstrably false. There's no such thing as a correct choice. Life is too complicated. The circumstance,
explain that, because there are plenty of incorrect choices, right?
Sure.
I mean, what you're actually arguing for is a kind of under a regulatory cap, a kind of pluralism.
Yeah, it's a pluralism. So And much more local control. Let people do things in their own way. Let people give people back ownership of their communities so they can mm-hmm. run their schools in different ways within reason. It doesn't mean they can teach creationism necessarily. You can have, as I said, you can have regulatory cops at the boundaries. But what you can't do is have the cops grow vines into the field of freedom. So now nobody can do anything unless they do it one way. Mm-hmm. And doing it one way fails because it never fits the circumstances of time and place. I mean, sometimes there's an emergency. You need to make a decision right now. There's a tunnel that needs to be built under the Hudson River to supplement the 100-year-old rail tunnel, the two lines. And those old tunnels are in danger of falling in because of damage from Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. They need to get fixed. No matter how you build the new tunnel, it's better for the environment to do it, to start it immediately, because if the old tunnels have to close, which they mm-hmm. do periodically, there's like 25-mile gridlock. It not only, you know, the disastrous effects on the economy in the region, but it also is terrible for the environment.
So,
yet it's taking years to get approval.
Expand a bit on, you know, what coming out of the 60s, yeah, why did, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, well, we now have, you know, we're more sensitized to the environment. We're more sensitized sure. to historic instances of racism, of exclusion of racism, or people on the basis of gender and things like that. How did that translate into a world where we are, you know, just choking on red tape?
We were unwilling to accept the complexity of life and the fact that there's no such thing as a perfect regulatory system. So legal systems are never perfect. Contract law doesn't prevent everybody from cheating on their contracts. It provides incentives not to cheat on their mm-hmm. contract and provides a mechanism to enforce it. Criminal law doesn't prevent crime. It provides disincentives for crime and a mechanism for trying to keep society reasonably safe. The modern regulatory state is designed for perfection. Mm. You can't have a perfectly safe workplace. Safety itself is only half an idea. Question is what you're giving up to get it. So if you make children's play perfectly safe and every child is wrapped in bubble wrap, then the children don't learn to be resourceful. They're unhealthy because they don't exercise. I mean, they don't learn how to get along with people. They're dumber, mm-hmm. studies show, because their neurons don't fire when they're trying to figure out how to deal with their peers. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of costs to trying to achieve perfection. There's this wonderful quote from a 19th century English historian called Henry Thomas Buckle. He said, the truth of any matter lies not at its center, but at the edges where it intersects with all other matters. So we tried to create a perfect society. Well, everything involves trade-offs. Fairness involves trade-offs. Everything. And so you have to, it's fine to set the goals. I believe environmental protection is really important. Fine, let's set goals, but don't try to think that you can create a uniform system that will work for every factory.
So the idea there is to say, okay, let's set a generally acceptable level of pollution, say, or of some kind of particular right. contaminant, pollutant, and then you let different companies or different actors come up with different ways to hit those targets.
Yes, and so in that case, you can set examples of pollution. But the other thing is that in the Reinventing Government initiative, we worked on an initiative where a company could come to the government and say, it's very difficult for me to comply to meet this standard for, say, benzene, but I can actually, for less money, cut much more of another toxin. Mm-hmm. And will you accept a pollution plan where I'm over the limit here, but much below the limit there? And it gave officials, again, giving officials a measure of discretion. The discretion has to be transparent to say, Yeah, that's fine. It's overall better for the environment to do your plan.
So what happens in this scheme, which I find fascinating, and obviously you've been mapping it out in detail for the past 25 years. I think in Tri-Common Sense, it's the fullest form or certainly the most current. You know, what happens if that person is at the FDA and the manufacturers of thalidomide come and say, we're going to be really bad on this one, on this problem, but, women aren't going to be puking during, they're not going to have morning sickness.
Right.
So, it's all trade-offs. And I guess the question is, how do you then hold accountable? First off, where do you find these bureaucrats who are going to be willing to actually make a decision that they will be held accountable for? And then what do you do when things go wrong?
Right. Well, I'll unpack that.
Yeah.
Things will go wrong. The current system guarantees that things go wrong and drives people crazy. The reason to change the system is not just because it costs a lot, and not just because it reduces innovation, reduces the overall supply of human initiative, because everybody's spending half their day, literally in the case of doctors and nurses, up to half their day filling out forms that nobody reads. The reason to do it is because the American public is in revolt. Almost half of them voted for Donald Trump, a complete outsider, and another 25% of them supported Bernie Sanders, who's a socialist. So the alienation that this big brother form of government has put forth, with all aspects of it. Political correctness is just another version of this, where, oh no, that's not correct to say something. It might offend somebody.
So even in our day-to-day interactions at a most basic level, there's this desire for correctness that, as you're calling it, the only one best way to do things.
If King Lear might offend someone, then you can't teach King Lear.
Mm-hmm.
It's just absurd. It's like trying to run society by the lowest common denominator.
Right. We have in various contexts talked about this, but there are historic low rates of trust towards all the institutions of government, all the branches of government, declining trust among Americans, American to American.
Right, downward spiral. So what happens when you have a society when people are not allowed to say, well, I think that's not fair. And a big part of this book is about restoring the public vocabulary of morality.
Mm-hmm.
Public choices should be judged mainly by their practicality, they're completely impractical, and by their morality. We've lost any discussion of morality. The election of Donald Trump is, looked at one way, the result of 50 years of liberal relativism.
Okay, explain that, because Trump himself seems like he is a moral relativist, even if he's running as a conservative Republican.
Well, he is a relativist. He says, well, who are you to judge? I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and I still get elected. That's right. So we've lost the vocabulary of fairness. And what happens, and truthfulness, and stewardship for the common good, all these things that require... These are not simply wishy-washy values. They're preconditions to trust. You're talking about distrust. If parents get the idea that they can go to the school and say, my kid has the right to a $100,000 program because he has special needs and I found this program, and they get away with it, and that $100,000 comes out of the arts budget or the sports budget or something, then other parents are going to say, well, I'm going to start demanding my rights too. My son shouldn't have gotten a B. That's going to affect his college admissions. I'm going to go in and make a legal claim. Literally, this happens. And so when you have a society where the hierarchy of authority breaks down, where the teachers no longer have control of the classroom and the principal no longer has control over the teachers and on up the ladder and in every level, you quickly get into this downward spiral of selfishness as everyone rushes toward the fissures and the legal cracks to get something for themselves. And so what's happened in America is everybody now sees that where the games are, and they play the game. They have, I grew up in Eastern Kentucky. They have, you know, somebody goes and chops off their thumb deliberately so they can get federal disability. And then they have a party to celebrate that he's now on.
Is that, I mean, yeah, have you ever been to a thumb party? Or
I've never been to one, but, you know, credible journalists have written about them.
Yeah.
I mean, people, and so there's a scam having to do with disabilities in parts of the country. And it ought to be condemned as being, as cheating, which is what it is, as well as bizarre.
Although the big growth, let's focus on this a little bit to get at, you know, because I, as I said before, when I hear like your broad principles, I'm like, oh, this is exactly right. This is exactly it. But, you know, say with disabilities, you know, we have a couple of things that are going on in America. One is the a fairly significant drop going back to starting in the 60s, but accelerating in more recent years, of a decline in workforce participation rates by what are considered prime year earning year men, 25 to about 55. A lot of that, it's clear that it is fueled by an expansion of disability, the ability to claim work disability so that you get money through Social Security or a couple of other social welfare programs for things like anxiety attacks, soft, you know, back, soft tissue back problems. It seems unlikely that, you know, it seems very likely that the expansion of disability money is one of the things that is fueling the rise of, you know, people dropping out, men dropping out of the workforce. How, I mean, would you agree with that? And then how do you go about sorting that out in a way that is not simply random or
uncaring? Yeah, but there's kind of a hydra-headed problem here, which is you also have a decline in opportunity because the coal mines have closed down because for a variety of reasons. Jobs get moved offshore because it's cheaper to build a refrigerator in Malaysia or whatever.
Or even if it's being built here, you know, robots take many jobs.
Robots do it. So, I mean, the challenges of this century, of which that's one of the main ones, are really significant. And government is not really dealing with those. They're not training programs. I think Tom Coburn did a, when he was senator, did a study of, I don't know, 250 training programs. Most people had not even studied whether they're effective or not. If they did study them, they were ineffective. Most training experts say training really doesn't work unless you tie the particular trainee to a particular employer, which is what they do in certain European countries, so that there's actually incentives on both sides to get it right, you know, and figure out how to do the welding or to do the coding or, you know, whatever the person is doing. So there are all kinds of problems here. Instead, we create these abstract top-down systems out of Washington. It's just example of what we're talking about without any accountability.
And literally, so, in that sense, you know, there are hundreds of federally funded or federally subsidized job training programs. And many of those are not even evaluated to see if they are in any way, shape, or form.
No, in fact, in Washington, Washington basically needs to be replaced. Not repaired. It can't be repaired. They don't. The quote.
So now you're sounding like Trump, right?
No,
you want to blow it up or drain the swamp or burn it down.
Yeah, exactly. So the Washington is an accretion of programs and laws. Mainly in the last 50 years, although there are a bunch left over from the New Deal era as well. No one goes back and says, do they work? No one ever turns them into codes that are actually coherent. They're just it's a junk pile. It's a junk pile that wastes a huge amount of money because Washington no longer has the capacity to adapt. It might as well be the court of Louis XVI. I mean, it's a centralized bureaucracy where everyone assumes that they know best. It's worked this way for decades. The people there can't imagine it working in any other way. We have a disability program, so that's the way it works. Well, guess what? Whether somebody's disabled requires judgment based on principles. There's no mathematical test about whether soft back, you know, some injury is important. People have to use their judgment, and there need to be limits on how much we spend on it. I mean, people are, it's, you know, the abuse stories are, you know, we could go into another podcast. You know, there's a huge amount of abuse there. So this giant junk pile requires people who want to actually roll up their sleeves and say, well, what makes sense? What training programs make sense? Well, probably none of them. And so Donald Trump comes in and he says, let's drain the swamp. And that sounds good, but then you scratch the surface. What does he really mean by that? And I was on Trump's CEO council, so I was down there working with them, trying to do, you know, infrastructure work. What they really mean, if you look at their actions, is deregulation. Mm-hmm. Now, there are a bunch of things that need to get deregulated. I've written books about them. Mm-hmm. But most of the things that we're talking about, a disability program, nothing wrong with a disability program. You just have to draw the line. Mm-hmm. Worker safety, I'm for worker safety. The 4,000 rules are not effective. They're probably counterproductive, actually, because it makes people focus on complying with you know, whether there's natural or artificial illumination in the stairway and check that box instead of actually complying with, you know, whether people are adequately trained for safety, which is much more important. So most of the problems in government that we're dealing with are problems of implementation. You know, that people are wasting their time doing this baloney, like covering the apple cart with the cloth, instead of being left free to focus on doing their job with regulatory goals that are simple enough that they can internalize them.
Before we get to how we fix this or how we address, you know, fixing this, tell me more about what were the contributions in terms of getting to this place? What were the particular contributions then of conservatives, of liberals, and of libertarians? And I want you to, you know, rehearse your criticism of libertarians as well. But sorry, well, you know, you mentioned with conservatives because, you know, this is the whole, you know, I guess not the modern conservative movement per se, but the Reaganite conservative movement is summed up in, you know, when he said, you know, the government isn't the solution to your problems. The government is the problem. And yet we come out on the other side of Reaganism and there's more rules and more a bigger federal government than
right.
ever.
Right. So the conservatives and libertarians, and I think they're different in focus, are correct in my view in their principal precepts, which is that for libertarians, that humans being free to follow their star and make mm-hmm. things happen is how everything works. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of human freedom and pressure and tension and all those accountability, all the stuff that Hayek and others wrote, is completely correct. And conservatives are correct, just as our framers were correct, in being concerned about abuses of state power. So let's stop there. But conservatism, and depending on which libertarian talks mm-hmm. to, libertarianism has become absolutist. All government is bad. All government authority is bad. Well, that's actually counterproductive. If the teacher doesn't have authority over the classroom, the student isn't free to learn because there'll be disruptions. You know, if the official doesn't have authority to give the permit and use common sense, it's going to take 5 or 10 years to get the permit and the project will cost twice as much or it's not going to happen at all. So you can't simply say authority is not a zero-sum game. In fact, if you don't have a functioning hierarchy of authority, and Hayek made this point, if you don't have a functioning hierarchy of authority, you don't have a functioning free society. You know, a society needs traffic cops. Otherwise, we get gridlock. We have gridlock today because we don't have any mm-hmm. traffic cops. You know, all we have is this jumble of red tape. So that's where I think the conservatives and libertarians mm-hmm. get it wrong. I mean, no new taxes, for example. No new taxes. You know where it comes from. I mean, the government wastes a lot of money. I agree with that. I write books about it. But have an absolutist pledge there. That means, okay, so then we can't rebuild the infrastructure. And by the way, I haven't seen the conservative alternative to Medicare that makes it more cost effective. So no new taxes means that we're giving our children a huge debt burden because we're not paying for our own health care. It's just unbelievably immoral what we're doing in pursuit of this absolutist idea, no new taxes. Well, okay, if you want no new taxes, then come up with a coherent plan to cut the budget so we can live within our means. And the conservatives aren't doing that.
And then
how about liberals? Can I? Yep. I want to attack liberals. Come on.
Yeah.
Liberals. So this whole idea, this whole idea of individual rights, the rights our framers gave us were rights against state power. That's why we're free. The state can't come in and take our property or throw us in jail without due process of law, that sort of thing. The modern rights, the rights of the person not to be offended by King Lear, or the rights of the person not to lose their job, they're rights against other free citizens. You know, it's basically power. It's people wielding a sword. They call it rights. It's not rights. It's coercion. You can't run a society. You can't get on a high horse and wave a sword, you know, and say, give me my rights. You know, it just makes everybody, instead of making everybody free, everybody's cowering in a corner. You know, businesses no longer give job references. We have a daughter who's a elementary school teacher, she's not allowed to put an arm around a crying child. It's just absurd, all in the name of, quote, rights. I mean, this.
Well, and in the book, you take a lot of swings at kind of public sector unions and collective bargaining. What went wrong there?
Oh, boy. So this is really important. You know, I believe that officials, hemmed in by law and goals and principles and overseen by courts, officials have to have a measure of authority to make sense of their situation and be accountable for it. Nobody's going to give them even limited discretion unless they can be accountable when they're jerks. We all know people who abuse their power. It happens not with most people, but it will happen with some people. So people have to be accountable. We all know that teachers and public employees are not accountable. This is actually a relatively new phenomenon. We forgot that. It happened in the 60s. It used to be that the president actually had authority to fire civil servants who didn't do their job. And there were constitutional rulings by the Supreme Court that said that Congress could not take away that authority. And then people sort of forgot about it. And first with John F. Kennedy, and then in the Civil Service Reform Act 1978, they gave public unions the right to collective bargaining. So in effect, public unions figured out how to become the main interest group for politicians, and they got themselves absolute immunity from accountability. The result is some bad teachers, but the worst result, and I write about this extensively in the book, which people haven't thought about, is to the health of the institutions that the people are in. If you're in an organization where everyone knows it doesn't matter what you do, the culture of that organization, it's like letting air out of a balloon. All the energy dissipates. It's almost impossible. It happens, but you have to have great leadership. It's almost impossible to have a good culture, have a good school, a good public office, if everybody knows it doesn't matter what you do. And so what's important is not to go around firing lots of people. What's important is for everybody knows that if you don't do your job, you will get fired.
Right.
Because then you can trust the fact that the person down the hall is working hard, and you can come to work excited that you're making a difference in the school or wherever it is, because everybody's working hard and in it together.
What is you name a couple, but what's an example of an agency or a part of the government that you think works well along the lines that you think?
Oh, you know, it's amazing. Government works as well as it does. Actually, there are these professional bureaus like the Weather Bureau, Michael Lewis talks about in his new book, The Fifth Risk. The Centers for Disease Control, happens to be in Atlanta, has a famously good culture. You know, when the Ebola crisis struck, they asked for volunteers to go to this really dangerous part of West Africa where you could catch the disease and die, and 2,000 people volunteered. I mean, it's just extraordinary. So they're committed to their mission, and there are lots of government offices where because of either tradition or because of great leadership, that happens. But the general rule, as in Washington, is that there's no cultural responsibility.
Well, at one point in the book, you do write, and I think, you know, this is part of your understanding of the Trump phenomenon, that change is coming, that the old order is rapidly fading, to quote Bob Dylan from right. 50 years ago. What do we do to speed up change, and what are the principles, you know, of reform that would work well for you? What do you want to see come after the fall?
Yeah, it's so important. People tell me, oh, you're just tilting at windmills, change is impossible. I say, change is not impossible. It is happening. Donald Trump got elected. People are really angry in this country. They hate Big Brother. The needle's going to keep swinging wildly. Who has a coherent vision of how to actually do the things that America needs, which I include starting with giving back to people ownership of their daily choices, you know, in their local communities. Let people take responsibility again and feel pride in, you know, when they wake up in the morning and mm-hmm. in a job well done. You can't repair this system. It's 100, in the federal government alone, it's 150 million words of binding law and regulation. It's well beyond the capacity of any human mm-hmm. to know or comply with. It needs to be radically simplified into goals and guiding principles with a clear hierarchy of authority to safeguard against mistakes and abuses, because people will make mistakes and they'll abuse their authority or whatever. So you need to have, you know, ways of doing it. And the way you do that, so law should look more like the Constitution. Constitution that doesn't tell people how to protect free speech or how to protect unreasonable searches and seizures. It just has those goals. And those things have been interpreted over the years, and people feel pretty comfortable those things work. So we need an entirely new system.
So can I ask, I mean, you know, just to make it a little bit specific, if you're talking about, say, pollution or education policy or whatever, the federal government, I mean, we have a nesting set of authorities legally in terms of government. The federal government might say, okay, for federal education dollars.
Right.
You know, here are the goals that we want, and if you want this money, you have to hit these goals.
Yes, but the goals are not fixed metrics. Metrics have their own mm-hmm. tyranny. You know, you tell doctors that they're going to be judged by the mortality rate of their patients, then they're not going to take the hard cases, because mm-hmm. hard cases, people will die. You know, so metrics have their own mm-hmm. metrics are a useful tool, but they're not.
So then, whether it's education or whatever example you want to use, how do you take it from the federal level down to the...
First of all, I think the principle should be every public school should be able to operate with the same freedoms as charter schools. Mm-hmm. So give the people on the ground ownership of their schools. Let them be invested in their schools. Don't mm-hmm. tell them how to teach. Don't tell them how to do anything.
Except for creationism.
Well, again, I would draw lines. That's okay. Right. I mean, I might draw the line at creationism. On the other hand, if the state passed a law and says they believe in creationism... You know, my father was a fundamentalist minister.
That's the type of argument that you'd be having.
Yeah. So we'd have the argument about where the outer boundaries are. I would have block grants, you know, not detailed record keeping. I would say, you mm-hmm. know, if you have this many poverty children, you get a block grant for this much. Mm-hmm. And your obligation is generally provide food. We're not going to tell you how to make it nutritious, but it should be.
A lot of this at the federal level, it is taking, instead of the federal government saying, well, hey, we're giving you 50 cents on the dollar or 20 cents, or here's a dollar, you're doing things 100% our way. I mean, they're kind of like, I watch a lot of Shark Tank. They're like venture capitalists who put in a little bit and then get to run the whole thing.
It drives people nuts. I mean, drives schools. I mean, it's literally schools are run to satisfy the person who gives you 5% of the budget. It's absurd. Mm-hmm. Every expert on education will tell you that. It's absurd. So they should give block grants, and they should judge schools just like we should judge people based on their overall performance.
And how you make that case might change depending on the school. Like, would you say then a school or a state has wider latitude to say, look, we succeeded. Here is our case for how we succeeded. And they would make that case to the federal government for continued funding.
Sure. We've succeeded. Or, more relevant, we haven't failed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, again, law is mainly about avoiding bad things. It's not about making good things. Mm-hmm. You know, free people make good things. Free people go out in society, go into the schools, whatever, and they can make things great. Law can't make a great school. What the federal government could do is safeguard against the bad things. You can't exclude special ed kids. You know, you have to provide reasonable programs for special mm-hmm. ed kids. You could do it in your own way. Today, because of the federal, unbelievably overbearing federal mandate on special ed, we are now spending over 25% of the total K-12 budget on special ed kids. About 13% of the kids are getting it, but only 6% of them should be in special ed at all. Mm-hmm. So we're spending basically 25% for 6% of the kids, and a lot of that is spent in bureaucracy, is filling out individualized education plans. It's all this kind of having hearings whenever mm-hmm. there's a legal hearings, whenever there's a dispute. That's not how other countries do it.
Okay. So that's, you know, the kind of basic idea is that at every level of government, you give more freedom for the level that's reporting to you to kind of figure out a way to get to the point. This is the idea about correctness. We throw out correctness. We allow pluralism, a wide variety of ways to reach particular goals.
Right. Human responsibility is really a basic point. I mean, it's the way any societies and organizations have worked since the beginning of civilization.
So
people take responsibility. They do something. And they're accountable for how they do.
So you talk, I mean, you know, and this is where, because for me, where things get, you know, get harder to figure out is like, how do you actually make this happen? One of the things you talk about in the book is moving federal agencies out of Washington. What would that accomplish?
Oh, the culture of Washington is, it's like a deviant subculture. I mean, people, it's been so long since people actually took responsibility to make something happen as opposed to push the process. I could give you, you know, literally countless stories from my years of sort of working in Washington. But, you know, you ask somebody, well, who has responsibility to give a permit? They say, well, this person has responsibility. I say, really? Where's that? Where's that authorized? Or what decision have they made? They say, oh, they don't have responsibility to give a permit. They have responsibility to set a timetable. And then somebody else has responsibility to deviate from the timetable. It's all this process.
You know, so then how does moving things out of Washington address that?
Because Americans everywhere else in the country, they get up in the morning and they know they have to get the job done. You know, I mean, New York is great. Everybody, you know, not everybody, but motivated by greed. You know, people want to make more money. So they get up and they try to, you know, make money and they either do or they
so
don't.
So physically decentralizing the federal government, you think would help to kind of decentralize or disperse decision making?
Completely. It puts people in a culture where bureaucrats get laughed at if they said the sort of things they say in Washington. I mean, one of the reasons people are fed up is political correctness and, you know, the alienation. But also, just look at the people in Washington. Watch a hearing. Everything is phony. You know it's phony. Everybody watching it knows it's phony. Both parties, it's phony. It's just this made-up stuff. Move the FDA to San Diego or Boston. They got plenty of scientists there who know about life sciences, who are used to thinking about the fact that there are trade-offs. Yes, there may be side effects for this new drug, but guess what? This is going to save 10,000 lives a year. And we haven't seen it. And if it turns out there are side effects we can't figure out, we can take it off the market then. That's a far better way of governing than adapting back and forth. Washington has no capacity to adapt to anything. It's just an accretion of more and more rules.
If that is the kind of policy side of things, what about, or one way to implement this is, you know, spreading out, and you point out in the book that, for instance, Centers for Disease Control is in Atlanta. There's a number of agencies that are outside of Washington that do fine. Politically, what are your dreams or your hopes about, you know, because we're at a point now where people identifying, self-identifying as either Democrats or Republicans are at or near historic lows. That doesn't seem, it's right. a long-term right. trend. It goes back to the early 70s, really. Politically, how do you sell this in an age of, you know, Trump, you know, Trump versus Hillary and kind of political tribalism in a, you know, at its most fully formed?
Yeah, it's really, it's almost tragic what's happened. Because both parties are making out like bandits with this polarization. You know, the Democrats all hate Trump, right? So they're mm-hmm. filling the coffers of the of Democrats, and the Republicans either like Trump or they dislike.
Are terrified of Sanders or Hillary or
Elizabeth Warren or whatever. So they're filling the coffers of the Republicans. Meanwhile, the fabric of the culture in this kid is being torn apart by this. Whereas most people in the country, I believe, if you take away the interest groups that really control both parties, the public unions, the trial lawyers, the identity rights harpies on the left, the no new taxes, the absolute deregulators, you know, get rid of all regulation, Tea Partiers on the right.
By the way, I realize you just insulted me, but that's okay. We'll let that
fine,
pass.
Okay, fine. That's right. I'm happy. I try to insult right. everyone in the book. And everyone
I think you
in
have broadly achieved your that goal.
But you can if you hive off what I'll call the absolutists, mm-hmm. you know, or the rent seekers on both sides, you could have a movement or a party that included cutting red tape, constantly adapting regulations, getting mm-hmm. more local control of you know, sort of choices, letting people be free to do those, and also deal with climate change and income stagnation and some mm-hmm. of the other stuff that the moderate left, I think rightly, thinks we should deal with. We're not divided as much as the parties have made us. It's just these extremists on right. both sides. So I think there needs to be a new movement. Nothing's going to happen because, you know, I talk to somebody, you know, or say pretty please. It's only going to happen if people really get fed up with the parties and say, let's band together, not behind a list of reforms, not to promise whatever it is, climate change or cutting taxes mm-hmm. or whatever, but a set of principles. And the principles, I think, are just not that hard. The principles are give back to everybody, citizens and officials, the ability to take responsibility. And give other people the freedom to hold them accountable. Hmm. You know, so that means you do away with the public unions. You know, that involves big changes. We have to start judging public choices not by kind of dictating things in a kind of a instruction book, but having goals and judging them with balance and looking at it, is this practical? Is it really working? Is it moral? Is it fair to be spending all this money on disability when we have no money for something else? And restore the ability to, you know, people can argue about fairness in a particular case without hating each other for life. If you put people in a room and say you're either for guns or against guns, or you're either, you know, for taxes or against that, you know, then they begin to hate each other for life.
Well, we are going to leave it there. We have been talking with Philip K. Howard. He is the author most recently of Try Common Sense, Replacing Failed Ideologies of Left and Right. Philip, thank you for talking.
Nick, great to talk with you.
This has been the Reason Podcast, and I have been Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at Reason, wherever you go. Rate and review us while you're there. Thanks so much for listening.